Hello, I'm Ian. Welcome to Creator Coco. This podcast helps you become a better creator by helping you learn from what other creators have already figured out. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can send us a tweet at Creator Coco. That's Creator and then C-O-C-O-A. In this episode, I talk about the big cycle from the book Principles for Dealing with the Changing World Order by Ray Dalio, where we examine history's most turbulent periods to learn about our present moment and how the future might be. I hope you learned something that helps you become a better creator. This episode was brought to you by Fictionista. Fictionista is an app for writing, where new sentences, storylines, and characters can be magically suggested to you as you write, using the power of artificial intelligence. With Fictionista, it's easier than ever to create new worlds and write that story you've always wanted to write. No more writer's block. You can download Fictionista from the App Store or the Play Store, or go to Fictionista.club. That's Fictionista.club. So today I wanted us to discuss a book, or specifically topics from a book called Principles for Dealing with the Changing World Order, Why Nations Succeed and Fail. This is not a play-by-play or a detailed walkthrough the book. I'm just going to try and summarize some of the interesting ideas which I found in the book. You should also check it out for yourself. And the Principles for Dealing with the Changing World Order examines history's most turbulent economic and political periods to reveal why the times ahead will likely be radically different from those we've experienced in our lifetimes, but similar to those that have happened many times before. This is a book by Ray Dalio, who is an American billionaire, investor, and hedge fund manager who has served as co-chief investment officer of the world's largest hedge fund. And if I was to give a synopsis of the book, it would be that if we can understand the past more thoroughly, we will better understand the present and better prepare for the future. A lot of times in our modern world, it's very easy for us to lose perspective about how things became the way they are. And even in our education system, the way history sometimes is presented is not in the most favorable way. It's not in the most enlightening way, and it's not presented to us in a way that is digestible and in a way that makes it interesting and that actually shows us the value of learning about history. When you're learning history in school, for example, sometimes they usually focus too much on memorization. And this goes along with other topics which you might encounter in school, including things like science and topics like that. But they focus a lot on things like memorization, things that actually take away the life from history. And when you think about history, it's actually the story of individuals just like you and me who ended up doing either great or, you know, infamous things, or they ended up doing things that ended up changing society in some way or another, or they had interesting human experiences. When you think of the Romans or the Greeks or even the Mongols and the Persians and people like that, these are people who had very interesting life experiences during their lifetimes. And it's important to be able to learn about them and to realize that history is the history of people. It's not about dates. It's not about specific events. It's about what were people going through at that time. What can we learn from those people at that time? So if we can understand the past more thoroughly, it'll help us to better understand why things are the way they are. And that's something I'll get into a bit later. So the book Principles for Dealing with the Changing World Order, it contains a lot of ideas. But I'm going to specifically pick one, which is called the Big Cycle. And this is the journey of a specific empire or a specific, let's say, a civilization or an economy, the cycle that it goes through from its inception, or when it starts to rise, up to when it declines. And I think this is an interesting idea to understand, because something that the book is trying to highlight is the fact that a lot of the things that we're seeing right now in our modern times have happened in the past. The only difference is that right now, our technology is different. It's happening to different countries. It's happening in a different time, in a different, you know, state of the world. But if you look back across history, and if you look far enough, you're going to start seeing patterns which are starting to repeat themselves, and patterns which are also cyclic. Why do things end up being cyclic? And I feel, or why do things happen in a circle? That I feel is part of a natural state of how things exist. For example, in our human lives, we exist for a certain amount of time, and we also go through our own cycles of birth, becoming an adult, and also getting older, eventually dying, for the next generation to come around. And that's kind of how a cycle can happen. So empires also have a similar cycle, and these cycles can be different. So just the same way human lives can be different, so one person can be born and have a different life, for example, die sooner than another person. It's also possible for empires to go through cycles like that. So not all the cycles are the same if you try and compare different empires, but a lot of these cycles go through similar trends and forces, and they go through similar similar pressures during their lifetimes that are relatable. It's just that the technologies change, the people who are involved change, and the times which those things happen change. And some of these things can also happen simultaneously, where you have some empires are on the rise, others are on the decline, and things like that, which can lead to conflicts and stuff like that. So when I say that empires have a cycle, I mean that they go through these three main stages, roughly categorized into the rise. So the rise is the prosperous period of building that comes after a new order. This is when this young, hungry empire, and also I feel like there's a lot of similarities between the idea of an empire rising and also the idea of a person who is, like, if you're coming from poverty or something and you want to become successful, the idea of you striving to achieve that success and what can happen to you after that, even across many generations. So you have this rise where it's a prosperous period of building that comes after a new order. And then you rise, you achieve great heights and great successes, and then you eventually reach the top. So the top is a period characterized by excesses in the form of high levels of indebtedness, meaning that you are borrowing money too fast, or you're borrowing money too much in a way that is actually decreasing the power of your own economy or the strength of your own finances. You also have large wealth and political gaps. This is something, if I can point to the US right now, or even just our economy right now in general. And for this particular talk, I wanted to not necessarily focus on what's happening in the world right now, although it's possible for you to be able to draw parallels and, you know, similarities between what I'm going to be discussing and what's currently happening in the world. I feel I'm looking at this more as an kind of a historical piece of research, as a way for us to understand the past, and that is going to also help you understand how the future is going to play out as well. But I'm not necessarily here saying that, oh, the US is about to decline and China is about to rise. I'm not so sure about that conversation, but that was an example of how political gaps can happen, where you have the left and the right, and the left usually wants to distribute wealth, and the right usually wants to maintain the wealth that they already have. Another thing when societies reach the top is you have declining education and infrastructure, so they focus less on in education, innovation, things like that. They focus less on their own infrastructure. And then that can lead to conflicts between different classes of people within countries, the rich fighting against the poor, because, and also the poor fighting against the rich, there's resentment building up and things like that, which can also lead to even struggles between countries, as these overextended empires, sometimes they can start like reaching out their fingers throughout the world and trying to establish bigger empires. You can think about the British Empire and colonialization, and also the Dutch Empire did something similar. And this situation eventually leads to the last stage, which is the decline. So this is the painful period of fighting and restructuring that leads to great conflicts and great changes and the establishment of new internal and external orders. It sets the stage for the next new order and a new period of prosperous building, and then the cycle can begin. So a challenger comes in and is like, I can sense that the current empire in the world is weak, and it's now my chance to try. And then they try, and then they also go through their own cycle. They start rising, they reach the top, and eventually they go through a decline. Now, it's possible for different empires to go through these cycles. And when you decline, it does not necessarily mean that that's the end of the story for you. It's possible for some empires, even like, for example, the Chinese Empire, that some Chinese empires in the past have declined and they've eventually risen. And so it's a cycle. It can go up and down. And if you decline, it doesn't mean that's the end of the story for you. But for a lot of different empires, that has been the case. So that's the cycle in a nutshell. That's a short version of the cycle, the rise, the top, and the decline. And now I want to go into a bit more detail about what I mean when I say that there's a, when I talk about this big cycle. So let's talk about the rise. Usually the rise of an empire is instigated and led by powerful revolutionary leaders who begin by gaining more power than the opposition. This can be through a political process. It can be bloodless. It can also be through conflict and war and, you know, a lot of bloodshed and fighting. And they end up consolidating power and gathering the people who support that particular leader around them. Afterwards, they start to establish systems and institutions which are supposed to support this economy and are supposed to lead this empire. If this is a person who is forward thinking, then they want this empire to grow. And then they start thinking about what kind of systems and institutions do I need in order for this economy to grow, in order for this country that I've just taken over, or this country that is currently, we need it to go on the rise. What do we need to do in order for it to go? Do we need more infrastructure? Do we need better education? Do we need more research? Do we need to create situations where investors are able to supply capital to businesses in order for those businesses to use that capital to grow? When you're on the rise, you start thinking about things like that. And it's also important to think about succession, specifically for empires, because for something like this to work out, it usually doesn't happen in the lifetime of a single human being. A lot of these things need several successive people who have the right kind of mindset for an empire to successfully go on the rise. A lot of the times in the past, this has happened through a hereditary system or a hereditary roll of the dice, where depending on who's born, like maybe it's the firstborn or whoever, they would eventually take power. And it stays within the family. And that's how usually they try to consolidate that power, and they try to use that power within their family. And it happens over successive people. So if your father was the king, then you end up being the prince. And if he dies, then you end up taking the throne. And that's how it worked for quite a long time. Nowadays, we have a different way of transferring power, which has become more popular, and that's democracy. One idea which I have recently come across is the idea that democracy is not necessarily about picking the best leaders. It's more about having the ability to remove leaders that don't really work out. Because in a case where the power is hereditary, where people are just inheriting whole countries, if you want to get rid of your monarch, it's going to be an extremely difficult process that's going to involve a lot of bloodshed, revolutions, wars, and things like that. But if you're in a democracy, if a specific president doesn't work out, it's much easier to change power than it would have been otherwise. And that's one huge benefit of democracy over some of these other systems. Although democracy also has its downsides, for example, it can be difficult sometimes to have a longer term outlook, because politicians are usually focused on trying to get reelected. And so the country can end up being short-sighted sometimes. But yeah, so let's say you have your powerful leader, you have gained your power against your opposition, you have consolidated it, and now you have a kind of a plan for succession. This usually can lead to a time of peace and prosperity and productivity, because a lot of times, since there is no conflict, since the opposition has been defeated, it gives everyone space to breathe. And you can have more peace. You can have people who have more space to be more productive and to practice their crafts, to implement the ideas that they have. And because the leader and the leading regime has started by setting up some of these institutions, you can end up with a situation where you have strong education and you don't just need to know technical skills and, you know, scientific progress and things like that. You also need a country which has strong character. You also need civility. You also need work ethic. And when you're on the rise, if you think about someone who's like, if you're poor and you're trying to succeed, usually these are things that you'll pick up because you are aware that these are characteristics of someone who is more likely to succeed, because this country will have less corruption and you're going to have people who are more cohesive and they're working together towards the same goal. Then when you're more productive in this peaceful stage of the rise of your empire and there's low corruption, this can lead to new technologies, more inventions, even more productivity. One example here is the Dutch inventing ships that can travel all around the world. The US has invented a lot of new technologies as well. And also the British Empire invented a lot of stuff. A lot of the scientific advancements we have today go back to the British Empire, the Royal Society, and things like that. And even capitalism at some point has to be invented by the Dutch in order for them to have a mechanism that allowed them to facilitate the success that they ended up having when they ended up dominating and taking over the world. So now this empire is a bit more productive. There's new technology flowing and they have more ways of making money and they have more technology. Individuals who are in that empire end up having a strong income growth. So they end up increasing the amount of money that individuals make per capita. Per capita is like per head or per person. Each person ends up making more money because you're able to invest in some of these companies which are succeeding. Your quality of life ends up increasing because you are benefiting from new technologies. You're benefiting from the safety. You're also able to start businesses yourself. And they start developing also capital markets. So the most important ones here are the ability to lend, the lending markets, the bond markets, and also the stock markets. So if you want to go get a loan in a bank, that facility has been created. If you want to get bonds, and also if you want to get stocks from different companies as well, you're also able to do that in an easy way. And this facilitates the process of people being able to invest their savings to fund new inventions. And this leads to even more prosperity and even more success. At this stage, this empire will start usually controlling the financial markets and will probably have the leading financial center. For example, Amsterdam used to be the leading financial center for the Dutch. London used to be the leading financial center for the British Empire, and New York is the leading financial center right now because the US is the leading empire in the world. When that happens, and a company and a society is that successful, usually what happens is they can use a lot of this money to buy a lot of defenses. And eventually, if people want to trade using the currency of that company, it ends up being the reserve currency. So, for example, the dollar right now or the pound in the past, this is the currency that people want to use the most when they're doing business. So if you want to buy goods across the world, which currency is the most accepted? And this usually puts this country in a very special position because they pretty much have more money and more power than any other country that exists. If they have an issue with they don't have enough capital, it's much easier for them to print money. And I'm going to talk about that and how that's a red flag and how it eventually leads to the downfall. and eventually end up having a reserve currency. And that's the process of going from the bottom to the top. So if I just give you a summary of how the rise works. So a new leader comes in, they gain more power than their opposition, they start establishing new institutions, the citizens start getting more education. Education is very important. They gain better character and they want to work harder. There's low corruption and new technologies, inventions start coming up. People are much more productive. So the empire experiences an increase in the share of world trade and strong income growth for its citizens, which ends up developing the capital markets. So you're able to lend, you're able to get bonds and stocks as well, which is a way for you to invest basically in the prosperity of the nation. So people can invest their savings into funding new inventions. They eventually also end up having the leading financial centers, and they can use a lot of this money that they're making to create a strong military, which can prevent even people from challenging their dominance once more. And eventually the highest state that you want to be in if you're an empire is that you want your currency to be the reserve currency, which is the currency that people are using and the currency that people want to use to save them, to save with the most. At this point, you reach what is called the top. So you are at the top of your game, you're at the top of the empire, everyone knows what's up, and people are rich. Now, this can also lead to a couple of weaknesses. Let's say you become rich, it's also likely that you're also going to become more expensive and less competitive compared to others. So, for example, people in the US are much more expensive to pay to do a specific task than people in other countries, because people in other countries are willing to do more for less. And that means that, and you're kind of more inclined to work with the people who are willing to do more for less, because the people who are rich also become less competitive. And the people who are not as rich as the leading empires start copying the technologies that the leading empire has been using, but they try to do it for cheaper. An example here would be that the British Empire started copying the Dutch ships. One thing that made the Dutch Empire really powerful is the ability for them to build ships that could travel all across the world and gather tons of wealth. So the British ended up copying their designs, but ended up using cheaper labor. So they were able to be more competitive in that case, and they're able to build more ships than the Dutch. And rich people also tend to not work as hard as people who are not as rich, and they have more time and money to spend on leisure activities, which are less productive. And this can lead eventually to a change of values from generation to generation between the people who work hard versus those who are born rich. And this is also usually part of a cycle that we are all a part of in our own families. Usually we are either the generation that is completely poor, or the generation that is in the middle, or the generation that is at the top trying to succeed. And a lot of the times you'll find that successive generations of people can either end up being poor, and successive generations of people can end up being rich as well. But when you are in a generation that is really rich and you just got your money handed to you and you don't really understand its value, it's easy for you to take it for granted, and your values can change and you can become spoiled. This means that you become vulnerable. And this usually takes place in a golden era. So you'll hear about some eras where things were popping for some of these empires, like the golden era of the Dutch and the Victorian era of the British. And because there's a lot of money and people have a lot of money, they tend to have the idea that the success that they have had in the past is something that will continue to go on. So people start borrowing money in order for them to bet more on the good times. So this is speculation, and people start basically betting on stocks, bonds, and borrowing even more money. And sometimes you can borrow too much money up to a state where you start becoming indebted to some of the countries who are even poorer than you. And because the wealthy people are able to borrow more money, it means that the wealth gap can grow. This is something we spoke about in a previous podcast. And there are different factors that can lead to a wealth gap growing. The main one is that the people who already have assets find it much easier to acquire more assets because they can use those assets as leverage to acquire even, you know, more capital, to make more money and those kinds of things. But there's also other factors, including things like nepotism, where the people who are in power or the people who are rich are going to use their wealth to gain advantage for their own children and the people that they know. And so the rich people are going to get even richer, which leads to a wealth gap. And ultimately, the cost of growing and maintaining this empire as it's spreading out across the world becomes greater than the money that it brings in. This also applies to something like colonialism. I know we like to think that it is the fact that Africans fought for independence, or a lot of these countries fought for independence, and a lot of them did. But one huge factor that resulted in colonialism ending is the fact that the British essentially were unable to maintain the empire. They didn't have enough money because it was all wasted on a couple of world wars. And so they could not afford to keep up and ended up having to let go of some of these empires that they were trying to control. So when that happens and the other people around the world start looking at your empire, it's possible that they might want to now, instead of holding your currency, it's possible that they may now want to sell your currency because it gets weaker compared to other currencies and they do not want to store their wealth in your currency anymore because something else might be able to come along. And this might now lead to the third stage, the decline. Because of all these tensions and all these issues which are brewing up in your society, because of the inequality and all the conflicts that are happening, internal and external fighting begins. Sometimes you can have civil wars. Sometimes you can have wars which are external, which you are having with other countries. And these can also, both of them, drain even more money from the society that it was at the top. But if you start having wars and being reckless, it means that you're spending a lot of money buying weapons and funding these wars. And that's not really something that is sustainable for the long run for a lot of these countries. And apart from the conflicts, you can also have things like the bubbles, which people were investing in or people were speculating in, busting because people had a lot of money. It means that they're able to basically push up the prices of some of these assets. And when that happens, eventually the bubble might pop. And when it pops, people begin suffering. And I mentioned earlier that also people start borrowing a lot of money. People are able to do that. And when governments start borrowing a lot of money and they're in debt and they want to pay their money and they also own the reserve currency, what usually happens is that they end up printing more money. When you print more money, you devalue your currency, and that can lead to inflation. Inflation and difficulties in an economy can lead to political extremism. So populists can come along and say, oh, I know what the solution is. I know all of you are suffering. I am the guy who will be able to sort your things out. Sometimes, okay, at least when I used to look at people who had that kind of a message, it's easy to think that this person is actually trying to change the political state of the country for the better. But it's also a good tactic if you want to get power and you want to convince people easily in a time of difficulty that you're the person who's going to come and save them. It's easy to say that you're going to come and fix things and you know what the answer is. And this is when our country is most at risk, when all these conflicts have happened. You have fights between left-wing and right-wing people. You have conflicts among citizens themselves. So you can end up with political extremism. And when things start getting tough, the government might end up raising taxes. And when taxes are raised, it means that the rich people who have the wealth, which is going to be taxed, they start moving their wealth away to safer places so that they can preserve it. And ultimately, if things get even worse in that specific country, revolution or civil war might happen. It does not necessarily have to be like a bloody situation, but some more often than not it is. And rivals are always watching. People are always paying attention to the game of power because there is always someone watching, someone trying to get what you have. And when they see that you are in a weak position, this is when other empires come and begin the process of trying to take you down or compete with you. In that state, you have to decide, do you want to spend money on a war? Or would you like to basically run away from the challenge? And if you do run away from the challenge, that's also a signal to the other people who are watching about the decision that you've made about how you're going to proceed. So there's also the situation where you decide to go to war and you end up losing this war. And that's an even more catastrophic decision because it basically means that you've been defeated and it's very clear to everyone who the new power in the world is. And the new power who has just defeated you, this can be actually not just a physical war, it could also be an economic war. It doesn't necessarily have to involve guns and missiles and things like that. But after that, the person who has, or the empire, which has just taken over from your empire, begins their rise. They begin their process of rising, then they end up reaching their top, and then they end up declining. So no system of government, no economic system, no currency, and no empire lasts forever. But almost everyone is surprised and ruined when they fall. If you look at some of the timelines of some of these countries or some of these great empires, they typically last about 250 years, give or take 150. If they have big economic debt, political cycles within them last about maybe 50 to 100 years. And since the Industrial Revolution, which brought about a lot of the changes that we are experiencing today, we have been operating in a system in which wealth and power have primarily come from the combination of education, people inventing new things, and also capitalism, being able to acquire support from investors to be able to fund your ventures. And nowadays in the modern world, digital things that seem to have no apparent physical existence, like digital information and things like that, they're now evolving to become worth the most. So there's now a fight about who obtains this data. If you read the book AI Superpowers, which I also spoke about in a previous episode, which is the battle for controlling artificial intelligence models and a lot of this data, and who's going to win that battle as well. And people are going to use that data and to use machine learning and to use AI to gain wealth and power as well. And that's actually another kind of stage that we are currently about to enter, or we are entering as well. So the formula for success, in summary, has been a system in which well-educated people operating in civility with each other come up with innovations, they receive funding through capital markets and own the means by which their innovations are turned into the production and allocation of resources, allowing them to be rewarded by profit making. And yeah, that's the cycle of the big cycle of the rise and fall of nations. So it's how nations can come up and it's how nations can come down. I thought this was interesting. I really enjoy history. I think that's something I've mentioned in the past. I think it gives you a lot of perspective that you would not have otherwise had. Like when you start actually getting interested in history and what happened in the past, it gives you a lot of context and appreciation for the time that you're currently living in. And it's something that I really appreciate having. So if you take something away from this, it's that if you can understand the past more thoroughly, you'll better understand the present and you'll also better prepare for the future. I've just shown you an example of a cycle that you can observe if you start looking throughout history. And this can also help you prepare for the future. If you want to either take advantage for the future or prevent yourself from getting, messed up, it's important to be able to have some of this information. So I hope you learned something. I hope this was interesting for you. And I will see you in the next podcast. Bye-bye.